From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, how the drive for quarterly earnings corrupted Wall Street and corporate America. We talk with Alex Berenson, financial reporter for the New York Times and author of the new book, The Number. It examines the obsession with short-term profits, which led many publicly traded companies to bend the rules of accounting and present overly optimistic quarterly earnings reports. Also, satirist and actor Harry Shearer. He's one of the stars of the new folk music mockumentary, A Mighty Wind. He satirized heavy metal music in the movie This Is Spinal Tap. He also hosts Le Show, a public radio program of political satire. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. France has proposed immediately suspending some UN sanctions against Iraq. The French ambassador to the UN said today that the ban on trade and investment in Iraq should be lifted. President Bush has been calling for a lifting of sanctions since last week, but other UN members, such as Russia, say UN weapons inspectors should certify that the country is free from banned weapons first. The White House says UN weapons inspectors are not needed in Iraq despite their readiness to return to the country. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
The Bush administration position on UN weapons inspectors is that they're not needed, that U.S. and British forces already in Iraq can handle the task. To date, no biological or chemical weapons have been found, a fact noted by Chief UN Weapons Inspector Hans Blix, who offered to return to Iraq. But White House Press Secretary Ari Fleischer responded this way when asked, why not beef up the search for such weapons by bringing in UN inspectors?
We have a coalition that is working on the ground to dismantle Iraq's WMD programs, and we think that's going to be effective. We think it will get the job done, and the bottom line is the president wants to focus things that are the most effective to get the job done.
Fleischer said the administration remains confident that it will eventually find such weapons. Don Gagne, NPR News, The White House.
Hundreds of thousands of Shiite Muslims continued to converge on Karbala, Iraq, today. The pilgrimage marks the death of one of Shiite Islam's most revered saints. Many pilgrims were bloodied by self-mutilation, a part of the ritual that had been banned under Saddam Hussein. Time magazine photographer Ben Lowy is in Karbala.
It's just throngs and throngs, crowds of people moving through the streets, every street in this city, hitting themselves. People are cutting themselves with swords, beating themselves with chained whips, and just hitting themselves with their own hands.
Time magazine's Ben Lowy reporting. The U.S. announced a ceasefire agreement today with a militant group of Iranian dissidents operating in Iraq. NPR's Ivan Watson has more on the group called the People's Mujahideen, which the U.S. and European Union consider a terrorist organization. NPR's Ivan Watson.
It was backed by Saddam Hussein, and it fought against neighboring Iran, which, of course, fought an 8-year war against Iraq back in the 1980s. This militia was equipped with tanks and artillery, and the U.S. military has announced that there is a ceasefire between the two sides. This has been welcomed by Iran.
NPR's Ivan Watson in Baghdad. Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials gained 156 points, or 1.9%, to close at 8,485. The Nasdaq was up 27 points. This is NPR News. Opposition groups in Nigeria are protesting the election that won the country's president another term in office. The opposition says President Olusegun Obasanjo's supporters committed election fraud, including illegally invalidating more than 2 million votes. The U.S. State Department says many of the claims of fraud appear to be credible. Negotiations over a new Palestinian Authority cabinet are at a critical stage. Palestinian officials say Prime Minister designate Mahmoud Abbas is ready to resign if Yasser Arafat limits his authority. International pressure on Arafat is mounting. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
British Prime Minister Tony Blair is one of the latest foreign leaders to call Arafat and urge that he make sure Abbas is able to present his new government by Wednesday's deadline. Envoys from other European nations and Russia have also weighed in on the side of the incoming prime minister, and White House spokesman Ari Fleischer said it was important that the Abbas cabinet be confirmed. The new government would trigger the release of the so-called roadmap for peace talks. Palestinians close to the talks say Arafat is balking at Abbas's desire to take command of the Palestinian security forces out of the hands of Arafat and his loyalists. If Abbas doesn't present his government by midnight Wednesday, Arafat would be free to name another prime minister and begin the cabinet selection process again. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Songwriter Felice Bryant has died at her home in Tennessee. She was 77. Together with her husband, Boudlow, Bryant wrote hundreds of popular songs, including the Everly Brothers' Bye Bye Love and the bluegrass favorite Rocky Top. She wrote most of the lyrics while her husband wrote most of the tunes. You're listening to NPR News. I'm Corey Flintoff in Washington.
The NPR online shop features Jazz for Blue Nights, the first in the I Heard It on NPR CD series at npr.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There are 14,000 publicly traded companies in the U.S. My guest Alex Berenson says that expecting all of them to be honest is unrealistic. But by the start of the 21st century, all manner of companies were abusing accounting rules to mislead their investors, seemingly without fear of being caught. In his new book, Berenson investigates the accounting methods many companies have used to help them publish profitable but misleading and inaccurate quarterly earnings reports. Berenson is a business reporter for the New York Times and a former reporter for the Denver Post and thestreet.com. His new book is called The Number. The number refers to the most important number in a company's quarterly earnings report, the bottom line figure of the earnings per share. It's a number investors are obsessed with, and Berenson says it represents the short-term mindset that infected Wall Street and corporate America in the late 90s. I asked him to explain how the number is calculated.
The base number, the number that the company reports, is its actual earnings, what its sales were, what its costs were. You sort of net those two things out. You subtract costs from sales, and you get profits. And right now, actually, we're in the middle of corporate earnings season. Companies like GE and like Microsoft are reporting their profits right now, saying we made, you know, X billion dollars in the first quarter, and we have, Y billion shares outstanding, so it works out that we made 25 cents a share, or we made 63 cents a share. And then Wall Street looks at that number and compares it to what analysts had forecast earnings would be. So, for example, if Microsoft made 25 cents a share and the estimate was 22 cents a share, everyone says, oh, this is wonderful. This is a great quarter for the company. The future is bright. It's a new day dawning. Buy, you know, buy, buy, buy. And the stock goes up. It can go up significantly. Certainly in the late 90s, stocks often went up very significantly if you beat your estimates. And then if the estimate was 28 cents and they report 25 cents, all of a sudden the sky is falling and the company stock can be absolutely penalized. And, you know, if this happens too many quarters in a row, suddenly the CEO is out and it's time for a change.
Now, you say that although the number is used by investors and it's considered to be very important, it's a lie. In what sense is it a lie?
Well, it's a lie because it's very hard for a company to actually calculate its earnings over any three-month period. It's a lie because you have to – people imagine that, well, I know how much I make and I know broadly how much I spend, so I know whether I'm saving money or whether I'm, you know, going deeper into debt. And so it should be pretty easy for a big company to do the same thing. In reality, the level of detail and complexity that goes into a corporate earnings report, a quarterly corporate earnings report, is almost unfathomable to the average person. You have to estimate hundreds and hundreds of different variables. You have to determine whether or not you actually made a sale, whether you actually got paid, whether, you know, the truck that you own went down in value by $500 or $700, and, you know, you multiply that by 20,000 trucks, and all of a sudden you're talking about some real money. And so to believe that a company knows to the penny, you know, or to the, you know, even to the $1 million if it's GE, exactly what it made in a quarter is a lie. And people used to, I think, understand that a bit more because it used to be that analysts estimated earnings within a range. They would say, well, a company's going to make $1.90 to $2 this quarter. And so if the company made $1.91, it was okay. If the company made $1.99, it was okay. But when you have a consensus estimate, you can't have a consensus range estimate. You have to have a consensus estimate that's to a point, to a penny. And so it became, well, Wall Street thinks the company's going to make $1.94 this quarter. And all of a sudden, if you made $1.92, it wasn't so good. And if you made $1.97, things were great, which is a silly way to think about things. But unfortunately, people, investing is complicated and difficult, and people like sort of simple maxims. And this became the overriding maxim. Did you make your number? Did you meet estimates? Are things good or bad? And so there was increasing growing pressure on companies to make sure they did make their numbers. And because there's variability in accounting, because it's fairly simple in any one quarter to make a minor adjustment here or there so you can make sure you made your estimate, then companies did start to cheat. And companies that were cheating already cheated more.
And when you say cheating, you in part mean creative accounting.
I mean, there's all kinds of cheating. But yes, I mean selling stuff when you don't actually think you're going to get paid, but counting it as a sale and booking a profit from it. I mean, marking up your pension fund more than you actually can make on it and booking that as a profit. There's dozens, literally dozens of major ways that companies can play with the rules. There's something called GAAP, generally accepted accounting principles. But within GAAP, there's a lot of variability, and there's stuff that is in the gray area of GAAP, and there's stuff that's clearly beyond GAAP, and then there's stuff that's, probably illegal, not just a violation of GAAP, but really a violation of the securities laws. And then there's stuff that's definitely illegal. So there's a wide continuum. But I would say that almost every company by the late 90s was at least pushing the boundaries of GAAP.
Accounting is in some ways an exact science. It's an empirical approach to figuring out profits and losses. On the other hand, there's a lot of subjectivity in actually making those evaluations when you're talking about big corporate accounting. And one of the areas where there is a lot of subjectivity within the analysis is in something called accrual accounting. Can you explain what accrual accounting is and why so many corporations really need to use accrual accounting?
Sure. Just about every big company uses accrual accounting because what it is supposed to do is match your expenses and your sales, not based on when the cash comes in, but based on when a sale is actually made or when you actually have an expense related to a specific product. So what you're trying to do is give people a real picture of how the business is running, because there are going to be times when you're appearing to be profitable when you're actually spending cash. I mean, and in fact, when you're going to be profitable, but your cash is flowing out because, let's say, you're building a new plant because demand is so big for that new car you just introduced. Well, you have to spend money for that plant. So if you were just counting cash flow, it would look like you were losing money. But that's not actually what's going on in the reality of the business. The reality of the business is that things are good and you're making money. And that's what accrual accounting is supposed to measure. People generally think about their own finances on a cash basis. The cash comes in, and fairly rapidly it flows out. It flows out to credit card companies, or it flows out to a restaurant. And you get paid on a monthly or a weekly or a biweekly basis. So it's pretty easy for you to match your cash flows. But for companies, it's a lot more complicated, and accrual accounting is supposed to measure that complexity. Unfortunately, it is an art as well as a science, because sometimes it's not clear that you've made a sale that you're going to get paid for. Sometimes you might be talking to a customer and they say, well, we'll take your product and we think we're going to buy it, but we want to test it out and, we want the ability to return it. Well, that is not really a sale, under any accounting, under accrual accounting. You shouldn't book that as a sale. But if you're short on your quarter and that one sale might get you there, you might say, well, let's count that as a sale, and we'll just write our customer a letter saying, you know what, you can return that if you want. We'll give you a letter on the side, but we won't put that in the contract, and we'll tell the accountants that's a sale. That's the kind of thing that shouldn't happen, but does happen, and accrual accounting allows to happen.
We've been talking a little bit about creative accounting practices that sometimes cross the line and mislead investors. Who's supposed to be making sure that that doesn't happen, that the accounting and the quarterly reports are as accurate as possible?
Well, the two main outside groups that are supposed to keep an eye on things are the accounting industry itself, which is, you know, if you're a CPA, that means you're a certified public accountant. And theoretically, you don't just have responsibility to the company, you have a responsibility to the shareholders as well. And then the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, which was created in the 30s after the first, you know, sort of huge bubble and bust in American markets in the 20th century, the 1920s boom that led to the 29 crash that a lot of people felt led to the depression. So you have the SEC and you have the accounting industry. And unfortunately, neither of those groups is quite as strong as we all would have liked to think. The accounting industry has a big structural problem, and that is that it is paid by the company. It's hired by executives, it's paid by the company, and yet theoretically it's responsible to shareholders. And so it's really trying to serve two masters. And it's during the 90s, you definitely saw a change in accounting culture, whereas in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s, these really were guys with green eye shades. They didn't think of themselves as salesmen. They didn't like to have to go out and pitch business. By the 80s and certainly by the 90s, there was a new breed inside accounting firms. And some of these people were not even accountants at all. There were a lot of consultants at the firms. The firms had gotten a lot bigger. They'd gotten to be more like companies and less like partnerships. And so the traditional accountant was sort of overwhelmed. And, you know, when you're a consultant, your job is to sell. And the way you sell to your customer, you know, if your customer is an executive, is not by telling him, you can't do that. That is not allowed under generally accepted accounting principles. The way you do it is by saying, well, let's find a way to make this deal work. Let's find a way to make that transaction profitable for you. Let's find a way that you can do this and report a profit. And that happened a lot in the accounting industry in the 1990s. And I think only now are we seeing how badly the industry was corrupted from the inside. And only now, I think, are accountants beginning to say, we do have some professional responsibilities that maybe we didn't pay enough attention to in the late 90s. But honestly, I'm not seeing as much of it from the industry as I would like. You have not seen the CEOs of the major four accounting firms that remain talking about their responsibilities that much. I think the accountants for 100 years have really tried to avoid facing this dilemma of being paid by companies while serving investors head on. And it's going to take a long time before they face up to it.
And what about the SEC? What is the SEC supposed to be doing to regulate financial reports and to make sure that they're accurate?
Well, the SEC is the last line of defense. The SEC, you know, its role is not to supervise every deal made by a public company. Its role is not to examine the books of every company every year. But its role is to make sure that in cases where there is fraud or where there is egregious behavior, that it steps in. Its role is to be the policeman of the securities markets. But unfortunately, the SEC just did not have the resources to carry that role out in the late 90s. It had 3,000 employees, which is twice as many employees as it had had 60 years before. And the markets are far larger and more complex than they were 60 years ago. They're far larger and more complex than they were 20 years ago. In addition, the SEC paid less than private law firms, than private accounting firms. And so, you know, really talented people at the SEC would say, well, I can make, you know, X at the SEC, or I can make 5X if I go work for a law firm. And eventually, that's a pretty hard decision to make, to sacrifice that so you can work for a government agency, especially if you feel like you're not getting the resources that you need to prosecute big cases. So by the late 90s, the SEC was pretty much overwhelmed. There's a great quote from a Republican congressman, I believe it was in 98 or 99, and he said, well, I think the SEC is doing a great job and doesn't need any more resources. Look at how many people are investing in the markets. To me, that's the same logic as saying, well, look at how many people are flying. Clearly, we can cut the FAA's budget. And yet, that was the logic of the late 90s.
My guest is Alex Berenson, author of the new book, The Number. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Alex Berenson, author of the new book, The Number, How the Drive for Quarterly Earnings Corrupted Wall Street and Corporate America. We talked a little bit about accrual accounting and how that could be used, kind of creatively to make it seem like you've made more profits than you really have. Can you just like run through quickly some of the other practices that you think contributed to the kind of faking of the number of the bottom line in the quarterly reports?
Sure. I mean, the two biggest are that companies counted a lot of their pension income as operating income. So that means essentially because the stock market was going up, companies were able to report stronger profits, and that obviously helped the stock market to continue to go up, you know, which sort of starts to smell like a Ponzi scheme. Another huge factor is stock options and the fact that stock options are not counted as an expense. And people who really know accounting, like Warren Buffett, think that this is a joke, that stock options are certainly a compensation expense. They're given to employees because they're valuable. And it seems ludicrous that you wouldn't have to count that as an expense. And yet companies did not count it as an expense. And then there's a variety of smaller tricks companies can do. They can sort of try to capitalize expenses, which means you spend money now, but you say, well, this is really for the future, even if you can't really demonstrate any benefit in the future from it, but you just stick it on your balance sheet instead of counting it as an expense. And there's a lot of other smaller tricks companies can use. If I can go back to the stock options for just a second, though, to me, that is another major contributing factor to the rise in accounting fraud in the late 90s, because what stock options did is they very closely tied CEO pay and executive pay to the performance of stock price. And in one way, that's a good thing. You want your CEO to be thinking about his stock price a little bit. You don't want him to be making bad investments. You don't want him to be wasting shareholders' money. But when you have a situation where if the stock goes up for 1 year or 2 years, the CEO can make $50 million or $100 million, really life-changing amounts of money, then, you know, he or she's going to be incredibly tempted to do whatever is necessary to make sure that stock price goes up and stays up long enough for people for him to cash out. And I don't think it's any coincidence that the biggest frauds of the late 90s, the biggest accounting scams, are generally companies where the CEOs took home 50 or 100, or in some cases, several hundred million dollars from stock options.
What do you think investors can do to be more confident of the numbers on the quarterly reports?
You know, it's a hard question, because unless you have a CPA or a CFA, or you're a chartered financial analyst, it's pretty tough to go through all this stuff and read it with a fine-tooth comb. There's a few things you can do, though. You can make sure you're diversified so that, you know, your life savings is not all in one company, especially if it's the company that you work for. That's a really big mistake, you know, the people at Enron made, people at Tyco made, people at other big companies where there's been accounting blowups have made, because in some cases the company is going to have to lay people off at the same time its stock is going down. So that's a really bad thing, obviously, to have happen to you. You can also say to yourself, does what this company is doing make sense? You know, people with Enron could never really understand how it was making money, and yet they continue to invest in it. Tyco, which is a company that I've written about, is a roll-up, and roll-ups meaning that it bought a lot of smaller companies. It mainly grew by acquisition, not internally. And roll-ups have a long history of blowing up, because there's a lot of accounting games you can do whenever you buy a company. It's one of the easiest ways to cheat is in taking over another company. And yet the guys from Tyco said, well, we do it differently. We're not like other conglomerates. We're not like other roll-ups. We really know how to run these businesses. And you have to ask yourself, you really know how to run five different kinds of businesses better than the existing management, and that's why your profits are so strong? You know, that story just didn't make sense. And yet, because the accounting profits were there, because they were able to show, because Tyco was able to get its accounts to sign off and show a steadily rising earnings stream, people just bought it. And so if the business does not make sense to you, you should stay away from it. Now, naturally, sometimes that might cost you some money. You might not invest into some great company because, you know, it was a little more complicated than you could understand. But in the long run, investing is complicated, and it's your money, and you really need to be careful before you decide to put it into a company.
Is there any more regulation you would like to see the SEC do of accounting and reporting?
I would like to see the SEC be funded in a way that it can carry out its responsibilities. I think we have the structure in place, and we also have something new called the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board, which was brought into law last year as part of Sarbanes-Oxley, the legislation that was passed over the summer of last year. And hopefully, Sarbanes-Oxley, which strengthened the penalties for companies that commit accounting fraud, and the Accounting Oversight Board will combine to strengthen a system that is pretty strong as long as the resources are devoted to it. What's been fascinating to me about this is I don't consider myself an ideologue particularly, and yet my book has generated some heat from the right, because there's definitely a conservative ideology that the market is always right and that regulation is a mistake almost at any level. And, you know, I think we've had too much of that philosophy in the last few years. And I think regulation is an important part of making markets work. I think CEOs do respond to incentives. I think if they see a high risk of getting caught and relatively low rewards because they don't have huge stock options, they're less likely to cheat than if they see no risk of getting caught and huge rewards. And so I think what as important as the regulatory structure is having the resources to make that real. Otherwise, it's just sort of dusty laws that are not enforced.
Well, thank you so much for sharing some of the things you've learned in the past few years. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry, and thanks for having me on.
Alex Berenson is the author of the new book, The Number. He's a business reporter for The New York Times. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Einstein in Berlin, a biography of Einstein's years in Germany from 1914 to 1932 by Thomas Levinson. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Local man, watching all the fish swim away.
Coming up, A Mighty Wind, we talk with satirist Harry Shearer, one of the stars of the new folk music mockumentary. And we'll hear some of the songs he co-wrote and performs.
Sunny land, coconut coming down all the time. Milk, she's sweeter than honey wine. Sitting here on the sand, he's a local man. Local man, crazy boy, he got a plan. Doing it just because he can. Yeah, he loco like ice. Cold, cold, cold local man. Sit in sand when you want to sweat. Go in ocean to get him wet. Sitting here on the sand. He's a local man. Local man, crazy boy, he got a plan. Doing it just because he can. Yeah, he loco like ice cold, 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 local man.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
As I travel down the back roads of this home I love so much, every carpenter and cowboy, every lame man on a crutch, they're all talking about a feeling, about a taste that's in the air. They're all talking about this mighty wind that's blowing everywhere. Oh, a mighty wind's a-blowing.
Three folk music groups from the 60s reunite for a concert that will be broadcast live on public television. That's the premise of the new folk music satirical film, A Mighty Wind. My guest, Harry Shearer, co-stars as the bass player and bass singer of the trio, The Folksmen. The two other members of the group are played by Christopher Guest, who also directed and co-wrote the film, and Michael McKean. These three actors also starred in the heavy metal mockumentary, This is Spinal Tap. They first performed as The Folksmen 18 years ago. In fact, The Folksmen have opened for the band Spinal Tap, confusing the heck out of some people in the audience. Harry Shearer also does many of the voices on The Simpsons, including Mr. Burns, Smithers, and Ned Flanders, and he hosts Le Show, a public radio program of political and cultural satire. Here's a song from A Mighty Wind's soundtrack CD, a song that isn't included in the film, The Folksmen's cover version of a Rolling Stones hit.
If you start me up, if you start me up, I'll never stop. If you start me up, if you start me up, I'll never stop. I've been running hard, you got me chicken, gonna blow my top. If you start me up, if you start me up, I'll never stop. You make a grown man cry, you make a grown man cry, you make a grown man cry.
Spread out the oil, the gasoline, I walk smooth, she's a mean, mean machine.
Harry Shearer, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thanks, Terry.
So describe the Folksmen and the groups that group is most modeled on.
Well, the Folksmen is a trio. We're hirsute in all the wrong places, we fancy ourselves probably the most purist of the second or third wave of folk acts that actually hit the charts. Everybody in this film is of the era of folkies that actually were trying to make hit records as opposed to going down and recording field hollers in Alabama. So we look down on the probably on everybody else in this film. The obvious guess that most people make is Kingston Trio, but there's a little bit of Peter, Paul, and Mary in this. There's a little bit of Brothers Four, although we're missing a brother. Groups like that, you know. We're trying to straddle the line between good timey and no, we're really saying something, but of course we're really saying nothing. And it's not that good a time.
No, as you were saying, the Folksmen just, you know, think of themselves as like the non-commercial band, the more real folk band.
Mm-hmm.
And they do.
And of course the public agrees with them.
Right. So I thought we'd play two versions of a song that you co-wrote called Never Did No Wanderin'.
Mm-hmm.
We'll have the Folksmen version, and then we'll have, like, the more commercial version.
Yeah, by the toothpaste commercial.
Yeah, the new Main Street Singers. So, mm-hmm. But first, tell us the story of writing the song.
Well, the writing process was really, as every other part of the process of making this movie, totally different from the normal Hollywood scheme. Chris, being the director, didn't have a list of songs he needed and then call us up and just go, I need this, 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 and this, and we did it to order. We really were, like, kind of making up the songs based on what we thought, you know, groups needed and what was funny about this kind of folk music. So Michael McKean and I were at my house one day, and I dug up an old record of the Hootenanny program. It was a primetime series on ABC featuring folk music. That's how commercial it got. Hosted by that old folkie himself, Jack Linkletter. And we were listening to a track by, tell me how folky this group name sounds, The Yachtsmen. And something in the song triggered us to start saying, you know, we need a song about rambling. Everybody's got a rambling song. That's one of the great cliches of folk music is rambling. I've been rambling. I've been going here and there.
And I started doing a little bass riff, and Michael and I started playing, and then we just thought, you know, the comic twist on this is a guy who never did no rambling, never did no wandering.
Okay, which leads us right into the song. So first the Folksman version, the pure version, and then the commercial sellout version, the new Main Street Singers. And this is from the soundtrack of A Mighty Wind.
My mama was the cold north wind. My daddy was the son of a railroad man from west of hell, where the trains don't even run. Never heard the whistle of a southbound freight or the singing of its driving wheel. No, I never did no wandering. Never did no wandering. Never did no wandering after all. Wandering. My mother was the cold north wind. My daddy was the son of a railroad man from west of hell, where the trains don't even run. Never heard the whistle of a lonesome freight or the singing of his driving wheel. No, I never did no wandering. Never did no wandering. Never did no wandering after all.
That's two versions of Never Did No Wandering, co-written by my guest Harry Shearer, one of the stars of the new folk music mockumentary, A Mighty Wind. Did you ever go through a folk music period yourself?
Not really. Christopher played folk music. Christopher played bluegrass as a youngster, which is, I guess, one of the purest forms of folk and or country music. It just really relies on very good playing, among other things. But I remember this music sort of swirling around me when I was in college. But I was sort of a diehard Frank Ella Mel Torme guy, so I'd hear this music, and every once in a while I'd hear like a weird chord in a Kingston Trio song, and go, they've been listening to the Hi-Lows. But aside
right.
from that, you know, this wasn't my music.
Well, the new Main Street Singers have some very Hi-Lows kind of harmonies.
Yes, they do. Well, John Michael Higgins, who performs as the leader of it and is also the vocal arranger of that, has that kind of ear. He grew up listening to. He said to me once, as the first person who ever said to me his experience being the same as mine, I just listened to arrangements. If I heard a good arrangement, I didn't care what kind of music it was. So he has this ear for great arrangements, and he just throws all these sixth and seventh chords in where they don't belong, just for the fun of it.
Well, you weren't used to singing folk harmonies. I mean, that's not the kind of harmonies you'd sing in Spinal Tap.
No, but, you know, they're sort of in everybody's head, I guess, or at least they were in all of our heads. That wasn't nearly as much work as, you know, everybody in this movie, or almost everybody, either picked up a new instrument or had to relearn. Gene Levy hadn't played a guitar in 30 years. Higgins had never played a tenor guitar. Catherine O'Hara had never played the auto harp, and Parker Posey learned the mandolin for this movie. So there was a lot of picking and learning going on. And, you know, a lot of trust by Christopher to believe that everybody would, because he recorded the music live in the concert sequences, to believe that everybody would be ready on that day to be in concert form. It's emblematic of the trust he showed us all through the making of the picture.
My guest is Harry Shearer. He's one of the stars of the new folk music satire, A Mighty Wind. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Wiley.
My guest is Harry Shearer. He's one of the stars of the new folk music satire, A Mighty Wind. He also does many of the voices on The Simpsons, and he's the host of Le Show, a public radio program of political and cultural satire. So did you have to learn to play or sing in ways that you had never done before?
I had to really get serious about the stand-up bass, the upright bass. Mm-hmm. We'd done these gigs from time to time, and I'd pick it up and just whack away at it a bit and then put it down again. But we did a couple of years ago, before we did the tour with Spinal Tap, there was a show at Royce Hall at UCLA. Hal Wilner put together a couple of evenings of a tribute to Harry Smith, who was a folk music archaeologist, I guess is the best way to describe him. And everybody came and did Harry Smith songs that Harry Smith had found. And we did three of our own songs because we couldn't be bothered to learn any Harry Smith songs. So everybody liked us because we were the best rehearsed people on the bill because we were doing our own stuff. And I had rented this bass, and I just thought, as every amateur does, doggone it, it must be me. I'm not getting enough sound out of this instrument. So I'd work harder and harder at it, and at the end of those couple of gigs, I had a real nice case of tendonitis. And that's when I realized, okay, I get it. I'll do what the real musicians do. I'll get a good instrument first and get it set up the way I like it. And, you know, and then really, then I played it every day until we made the movie.
Okay, time for another song. Here's another song by the Folksmen, and this is called Old Joe's Place. And this is the song that actually charted for them.
This is our hit. It got to number 17.
You co-wrote the song. Tell us about writing it.
This was, I think, one of the first Folksmen tunes we wrote when we did this piece on Saturday Night Live, and the premise was this washed-up folk group was, for some reason, getting a chance to appear on Saturday Night Live. And so you see them backstage before the show trying to decide whether they should do their Spanish Civil War song or some, you know, song about a real tragedy, a train wreck in a coal mine. You know, keep resisting the idea of doing the obvious song, which is the only one everybody's ever heard of us. And then, of course, we get on stage and do Old Joe's Place. So that was the gag. And it's a typical kind of good-timey folk song where every time the chorus comes around, it gets longer.
It struck me as very Burl Ives.
Yeah, I guess so. It's Burl something.
Okay, this is The Folksmen with my guest, Harry Shearer. Old Joe's Place from the soundtrack of the folk mockumentary A Mighty Wind.
Whenever I'm out a-wandering, chasing a rainbow dream, I often stop and think about a place I've never seen.
Where friendly folks can gather and raise the rafters high,
with songs and tales of yesteryear until they say goodbye.
Well, there's a puppy
in the parlor and a skillet on the stove and a smelly old blanket that a Navajo wove. There's chicken on the table, but you gotta say grace. There's always something cooking at Old Joe's Place.
Come by around evening time, as soon as the sun goes down. Some drop in from right next door, and some from out of town.
Pick it.
Well, there's a puppy
in the parlor, and a skillet on the stove, and a smelly old blanket that'll never hold. There's popcorn in the popper and a porker in the pot. There's pie in the pantry and the coffee's always hot. There's chicken on the table, but you gotta say grace. There's always something cooking at Old Joe's Place.
That's Old Joe's Place with my guest Harry Shearer, doing bass voice and playing bass as well. It's from the soundtrack of the film A Mighty Wind, the new folk mockumentary. What else did you listen to? You mentioned going back and watching old episodes of Hootenanny. But what else did you try to immerse yourself in to prepare for your role, to get into character?
Well, I can't tell you about some of it because it'll give away a big joke at the end. Suffice to say, there was a piece that aired on NPR a few years back that I'd cherished for its unintentional comic value, and I went and reviewed that for that joke. But we watched, there's a wonderful documentary about the Weavers, which focuses around a Weavers reunion. And since we were going to be reuniting after a long absence, we all looked at that as sort of a template for, you know, the behavior of these guys. I listened to a lot of I sadly, in my extremely eclectic and never surrendered LP collection have a lot of folk records that I'd never had occasion to listen to till now. For, you know, singing style and things like that. But in terms of character, it was, I did a little bit of research on guys in groups and just saw what their career trajectories were after the folk music scare, as Martin Mull calls it, evaporated, just to see, you know, how paths went before I kind of contributed my little bit as to what Mark Shubb, the character I play, what his life had been since the Folksmen broke up.
My guest is Harry Shearer, and in the new folk music mockumentary, A Mighty Wind, he plays the bass player and bass singer with the folk group The Folksmen. He co-wrote a lot of the songs in the movie. Harry Shearer also hosts the public radio show of political satire, Le Show, and he does a lot of voices on The Simpsons and has been in a whole bunch of movies. I know this isn't the first time that you've had to do satire about something as dangerous as war, but you know, what's it like for you, you know, when you're in the middle of war, when you're facing war, to then have to find the funny part?
Well, actually, this was much easier than doing what I do in the immediate wake of 9/11. I think that had a much more traumatic effect on a lot more people in the audience, and I just thought that was a more challenging environment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is another one of our remote control wars that we're kind of getting very good at. And the main difference was that, as with 9/11, some of my affiliates, some of them in a town very near to you, Terry, would start preempting me as soon as things got serious, you know. And my reaction was, "Hey, wait a minute! I'm doing material on this subject too. You know, I'm not doing my Pamela Anderson material right now, and it maybe is valuable for people to hear this at this time. Otherwise, you know, you just get far more inundated in terms of the media input, and I found myself watching and listening and reading to way more stuff than I do normally to try to keep up." Because, you know, when the news channels go, here's an odd moment, all news, then you have to kind of look behind what they're doing or look around what they're doing to see what else is going on. So I just found myself kind of obsessing on it, as I would normally anyway. But the radio show is just a way to have an excuse for the obsession.
My guest is Harry Shearer. He's one of the stars of the new folk music satire, A Mighty Wind. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Harry Shearer. He's one of the stars of the new folk music satire, A Mighty Wind. He also does many of the voices on The Simpsons, and he's the host of Le Show, a public radio program of political and cultural satire. When we left off, we were talking about the satirical sketches he did on Le Show during the war in Iraq. Why don't we hear an excerpt of one of the sketches that you did, and this is Extra Access Tonight, which is your version of Access or Extra or Entertainment Tonight, Access TV. Yeah. So this is them talking about how the news is affecting, how the war news is affecting television and the Academy Awards.
If it's wartime, this must be Tuesday, and television programmers are adjusting at a pace that must be stimulating shock and awe in the competition. The Motion Picture Academy decided that the first victim of this war was the red carpet arrival ceremony, leaving Oscar pre-show hostess Joan Rivers
dishing her heart out.
I mean, it's a gray carpet. I mean, what are you supposed to do with that? That's for the dignity. I mean, yeah, if they wanted dignity, they should have told Courtney Love to stay home. Okay, she's not really at the Oscars this year. But, I mean, what are we supposed to say as these people arrive? Ah, can you believe that gray suit? Oh, my God, those lapels are notched. I mean, you know, it's all right for me. I have a career. But poor Melissa.
Co-executive producer Jamie Mullarkin is making last-minute changes in NBC's hit reality show, Fear Factor.
All the insect-related stunts are out for the duration of the hostilities. We've been banking less disgusting challenges for just a situation like this. This week, the contestants all have to eat sweetbreads. You know, it's still like yick, but it's a classier kind of yick.
On the news side of the networks, the competition heats up in wartime. We talked to CNN's Aaron Brown.
In terms of the people over there, everybody's, you know, sent their A team. So it is really a contest about in the chair next to the anchor, who's got the best former generals. And I just happen to think our former generals are top of the line.
Not surprisingly, Dan Rather has a different take on the war. The network war.
Tell you this, CBS News is a gold standard type television news operation. We've got two mandates that we're crippled critter serious about. Do the best possible electronic journalism about this conflict, real pedal to the metal journalism. And two, make rock solid sure for certain that we don't put the Howard Stern prank caller on the air anymore. For the
networks, there's one. That's an excerpt of a sketch from Harry Shearer's public radio program, Le Show, with Harry Shearer doing all the voices.
That's a good example, Terry, of how one can work comedically in times that people might think, whoa, this is a little serious, this is a little dramatic. What are you going to do, make fun of the killings? No, the media, one way or another, is always ripe for satire at times like this,
especially people like Aaron Brown, who has been a particular bête noire of mine lately. I think you may.
That's Aaron Brown from CNN.
Aaron
Why
Brown
is
from CNN. Well,
you know, first of all, Aaron Brown, one trick I've learned is you kind of try to figure out who. If you're trying to do somebody, get a character, you try to figure out whom they're doing. I realized when I was trying to get a hold of the character or the voice of Dick Clark, that Dick Clark had actually grown up listening to Arthur Godfrey, and that kind of helped me figure out how to do Dick Clark. You know, because Dick Clark has this relaxed way of talking, and I thought, who was he listening to?
That's great. That's really interesting.
And with Aaron, you can hear he spent way too much time watching Ted Koppel, because Ted Koppel has this. Ted Koppel will never say it. He'll always say it is a, you know, to kind of focus you on the thing he's going to say.
And Aaron has, it is a very hard story we have to.
And then, of course, it's just his insane self-obsession. Like, we care how hard it was for them to do the story, you know.
Andrea Koppel, you've had a long day. Take the rest of the night. Do that on email. Don't do that. Don't waste airtime.
That dates back to Entertainment Tonight, I think. Because that's the first time, like years ago on Entertainment Tonight, when people would be complimenting, Leonard, that was an excellent film review.
Oh,
thank
God.
You for that.
Well, it actually goes to, I think before that, to local news, where they were just told to chat with each other. And Bill, good weather tonight. Good. That's a good-looking forecast. I'd change that suit jacket, however. That stuff, you know. I think it all started, everything bad started with local news.
Well, Harry, I think we'll close with a great sketch that you did of the Larry King Show. Do you want to say anything about this sketch before we hear it?
The guest on has been on with Larry before. Right after 9/11, he premiered a song that he had called "Where's Your Flag," which was just challenging businesses. He was saying he wasn't going to go into any business that didn't have a flag in the window. And I told you this off the air. My favorite story ever about being recognized was when I was flying into San Francisco Airport recently. And I was in the men's room just washing my hands, you know, because of the epidemic and everything. And you don't like to be approached when you're in the men's room. But a guy walked up to me sending very strong non-stalker vibes and just said two words to me, "Dewey Gordon," and it broke me up. So
That's great. Well, Harry Shearer, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Terry, it's always a pleasure.
CNN coverage of the war in Iraq continues with a special edition of Larry King Live. Now, here's Larry King Live.
We're in Lexington, Kentucky tonight, where I'll be emceeing the Mint Julep Ball for the benefit of the Pulmonary Edema Foundation Monday night. Coming up next hour, our own Aaron Brown discusses his anxieties about the war with Dr. Phil. But right now, in a Los Angeles studio, an old friend of Larry King Live, even though he's young enough to be my son from my fifth marriage. He first hit the spotlight with the boy band Boys R Us. He's been on his own now for a couple of years, building his solo career. And he's with us tonight because, well, he's going to tell us why he's here tonight. That's why he's here. The fabulous Dewey Gordon.
Good evening, Larry. Thanks for having me back. Yeah. I know it's wartime, and I'm no general or journalist or anything.
Well, you know, Dewey, I think people want to know about the effect of the war on the ordinary celebrity even more.
Well, I hope so, Larry. Yeah. As you know, I don't think an artist has to keep his heart off his sleeve all the time. I think you remember I was involved in the whole post 9/11 patriotism thing before it was even a bandwagon. So
no, your song "Where's Your Flag" was topping the charts right up till the promotion money ran.
Harry Shearer from his public radio program, Le Show. He's one of the stars of the new film, A Mighty Wind. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a recording by Nina Simone. She died yesterday at the age of 70. This is her 1967 version of the Bob Dylan song, I Shall Be Released.
They say everything can be replaced. They say every distance is not near. So I remember every face of every man who put me here. I see my light come shine.
Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Harcourt, publisher of Big If by Mark Costello, a novel about what happens when the FBI, a campaigning vice president, computer war game programmers, and the American way of life collide. Available in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Jonathan Schell talks about the use of force in U.S. foreign policy and considers new ways of preventing war. He's a correspondent for The Nation and author of the new book, The Unconquerable World, Power, Nonviolence, and the Will of the People. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.